nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds.
Dr. Martin Luther King, 60 years ago today, talk about the bad check and how it made it into this speech, Gary.
Well, he was very keen that that there was some kind of analogy or description that would span in a way from slavery through to the 60s and make it clear in a as accessible a way as possible that short of talking about reparations, which you know wouldn't have really worked in that kind of venue, that America owes us. And it owes us morally, but it also owes us materially. There were some who were not keen on that kind of that analogy. They thought it went too far. They thought it was too crude. But actually, in some ways, I think it's the most. It's not the most florid piece of the speech, but it's in some ways the most important because it speaks to now that the check keeps bouncing. And in fact, in a way, things are going backwards. The account is getting worse. If you look at them rolling back the voting rights and affirmative action and so on. And one has to think, and some of the people that I spoke to for the book said this, how people would understand this differently if it was understood as the bad check speech, as the promissory note speech, how that might shift their understanding. Because actually what happens with this speech is that all sorts of people, awful people and good people, but the awful will take a moment from this speech and claim it, including Ron DeSantis did his anti-woke bill. He evoked Martin Luther King and that one line about his children being judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. That's the only line that right-wingers and Republicans know. And actually, even Ron DeSantis, even when talking about banning books that would really refer to the roots of this struggle, evokes Martin Luther King, which is why I thought it was so important to write the book, because I felt that he and this speech had to be reclaimed and positioned in its kind of rightful space, and I wanted to make a contribution to that.
And in talking about the bad check, the issue of the insufficient funds, it reinforces the name of the speech, the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, not just for freedom, talking about the economic plight of a population that had been formerly enslaved. If you can also talk about what is most misunderstood about August 28th, 1963, about this gathering where early in the morning reporters were on radio and television saying it looks like not that many people are going to come out. You have the amazing organizers of this speech, A. Philip Randolph. You have Bayard Rustin. Rustin, you write about taking out his watch and a blank piece of paper when reporters are saying doesn't look like you're going to have anyone coming to the speech. And he said, no, And the paper was blank. What did he say? We're right on schedule.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we have to understand that a march of this size had actually never been organized before in the capital. That the state assumed that there would be violence and militarized the capital to a huge extent, and in the end, there was no violence. That, as you have pointed out, it was a march of jobs and freedom, organized jointly, civil rights movement and the labor movement, class and race. An implicit, I think, understanding that to try and understand racism without class or class oppression without race is to really misunderstand them both completely. So that makes it a march for, as you say, for jobs and freedom. This force of energy that is Bayard Rustin, this gay African-American man who stands at the heart of the organizational excellence, really, in getting everybody into the city and out of the city, to the extent that the minutiae went to telling people, don't bring egg mayonnaise sandwiches, it's going to be a hot day, the mayonnaise will go off, it will get you sick, there are only so many toilets. That is the extent of the kind of organization that there was. A fragile coalition, which included some of the more conservative elements, and the unions were among some of the more conservative elements in some ways, and SNCC, and the sprightly, fighty John Lewis, the late John Lewis, whose speech was the subject of frantic last-minute negotiations because he wanted to talk about the protesters marching through the South as Sherman did.
You know, Gary, we've got a clip of John Lewis speaking at the march. He was the youngest speaker. He was 23 years old. This is John Lewis.
Those who have said, be patient and wait, we must say that we cannot be patient. We do not want our freedom gradually, but we want to be free now. We are tired of being beaten by policemen. We're tired of seeing our people locked up in jail over and over again. And then you holler, be patient. How long can we be patient? We want our freedom and we want it now.
We want our freedom and we want it now, John Lewis said at the age of 23, a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC. He originally wrote for this speech, as you were talking, Gary, about these frantic negotiations forcing him to rewrite his speech. He originally wrote, we cannot depend on any political party, for both the Democrats and the Republicans have betrayed the basic principles of the Declaration of Independence. We will march through the South, through the heart of Dixie, the way Sherman did. We shall pursue our own scorched earth policy and burn Jim Crow to the ground nonviolently. Take it from there, Gary.
Well, you see the energy of what will soon become the Black Power movement. You see the negotiations with a more religious, an older generation, and the union movement. In the end, it's A. Philip Randolph who says, I've been waiting for this moment, because A. Philip Randolph sought to organize a march on Washington, I think in 1943, certainly during the war. It may have been 42, but it was in order to ensure that Black people could work in the munitions factories. And he only called it off when Roosevelt relented and issued an executive order. And he said to John Lewis, young man, I've been waiting for this time kind of all of my life. Please do this for me. And Lewis relents. But then also that energy from Lewis also kind of tells a story about what happened during that year. Because at the beginning of that year, only Randolph and Rustin really wanted a march. The NAACP, the Urban League, all of those, They didn't really want anything to do with it. And actually, the SNCC crowd thought it would be like a big show, a march in Washington, whereas they wanted to march on Washington. And it's really the events in Birmingham, Alabama, earlier in the year, which force the leadership. This comes from the grassroots. It forces the leadership to say, well, now we have to have a march. We have to do something. And the story of that year is the leaders literally, figuratively running to catch up with the base, which on the day they literally do, because they go to meet Congress, the people in Congress, and the march starts without them. And they have to kind of run to catch up. And the picture that there is, which looks like they're leading the march, actually they're near the front, but they're not at the front. They just cleared people to make it look as though it was. And there's an interesting moment where King and Randolph and others, James Forman from CORE, they are in speaking to Kennedy just a week or so before the march. And Kennedy's trying to get them to call it off. And Randolph says, we want legislation on the Hill, not a big show, not Negroes in the streets. And Randolph says, the Negroes are already on the streets, Mr. President, and I doubt if we called them that they would get off. And that gives you a really clear indication of who was really driving this and what was really driving this.
Gary Young, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor of sociology at the University of Manchester, currently in Italy. He's the author of several books, including The Speech, the story behind Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream, which has just been updated with a new prologue for this 60th anniversary of that historic day in Washington. Gary Young's forthcoming book is Dispatches from the Diaspora, from Nelson Mandela to Black Lives Matter. Coming up, the city of White Plains, New York, has agreed to a $5 million settlement with the family of Kenneth Chamberlain, the black 68-year-old former Marine shot dead by police in his own apartment after he accidentally triggered his medical alert pendant and they came for a wellness check. Back in 30 seconds.
Freedom, oh freedom, oh freedom over me. And before I'd
be Oh Freedom, performed by Odetta. She performed Oh Freedom 60 years ago at the March on Washington. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The city of White Plains, New York, has agreed to a $5 million settlement with the family of Kenneth Chamberlain, a black 68-year-old former Marine shot dead by police in his own apartment. The tragic case occurred early on the morning of November 19, 2011, when Ken Chamberlain accidentally pressed the button on his medical alert system while sleeping. It was 5:22 in the morning. Responding to the alert, White Plains police arrived at Chamberlain's apartment in a public housing complex for a wellness check. By the time the police left the apartment just after 7 a.m., Kenneth Chamberlain was dead. They shot him twice in the chest. A police officer shot him inside his own home. Police gained entry to Ken Chamberlain's apartment only after they took his front door off its hinges. Officers first shot him with a taser, then a beanbag shotgun, then with live ammunition. In a moment, we'll be joined by Kenneth Chamberlain's son and by the attorney for the Chamberlain family. But first, we want to turn to the remarkable series of audio and video recordings from the morning of Mr. Chamberlain's death. A warning, these recordings are disturbing. After the White Plains police arrived at Ken Chamberlain's apartment, he told an operator from Life Aid that made the pendant that he wasn't sick and that he didn't need assistance.
This is your help center for Life Aid. Mr. Chamberlain, do you need help?
This is an emergency. I have the White Plains Police Department banging on my door, and I did not call them, and I am not sick.
Everything's all right, sir?
No, it's not all right. I need help. The White Plains Police Department are banging on my...
Mr. Chamberlain, go to your door and answer it.
Yes.
Open your door for the police, Mr. Chamberlain.
No, police. I did not call them.
That's okay. Go to your door and let them know you're all right.
They're right here. They hear me. They say they want to talk to me.
Okay, so go and talk to them, sir. I'll stay on the line with you.
I have no reason to talk to them.
Mr. Chamberlain? Mr. Chamberlain?
Yes.
You pressed your medical button right now. You don't need anything. Let the police know you're okay.
I'm okay. The police department is knocking on my door.
Yes, I understand. Go to the door and tell them you're all right.
I will not open my door.
Go to the door and tell them you're okay.
I'm not
open my door. In a separate video, one of the officers, Stephen Hartz, heard hurling a racial epithet, the N-word, at Kenneth Chamberlain during the incident. Or they think at this point it might have been him. It might have been another officer. Then you hear Chamberlain say, "They've come to kill me."
Mr. Chamberlain!
They'll probably kill me with that because I have a bad heart.
It don't have to happen that way. How can I stand up there for that?
Get out! I didn't call you. I did not call you. Why are you here? Why are you here?
Why do I call you?
Why are you here?
Like the last caller.
They have been non-melodic as well.
I'm fine.
Despite Kenneth Chamberlain's comment that he had a bad heart, White Plains police broke down his door and they shot him with a taser. The date was November 19, 2011. 12 years later, the city of White Plains, New York, has agreed to a $5 million settlement with Ken Chamberlain's family. We're joined right now by Kenneth Chamberlain Jr. and Mayo Bartlett, attorney for the family. He's the former chief of Bias Crimes Unit of the Westchester County District Attorney's Office and the former chair of the Westchester County Human Rights Commission. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Kenneth Chamberlain, Jr., I am sorry to play all that for you, even 12 years later, the agony that your father went through. And now you have this settlement. Can you talk about what it means to you?
Well, good morning, Amy. The settlement itself, while, and not just speaking for my family, but other families as well, while it may provide some form of redress, it doesn't really address the broader issues when you're talking about police misconduct, brutality, and criminality. So I've always said that, yes, this should be part of the process, but it doesn't equate to accountability.
How did you arrive at the settlement, and what have the police admitted they did? And were any police officers charged for your father's death?
Well, no police officers have been charged to date. Now, as far as statements that have been made, I only know of one statement that was made by the PBA where they said that this settlement in no way is an admission of wrongdoing. And my response to that is very simple. If we're going to go with that statement that they made, well, there's one way that we can prove if there has been any wrongdoing or any bias, and that would be to unseal the grand jury minutes and let's see what the instructions were to the grand jury in form of charges.
Explain what you're asking for more specifically about the grand jury.
So what I'm asking for is since my father was killed, you know, in May of 2012, they came back with no true bill. They said there wasn't sufficient enough evidence to charge the officers in the killing of my father. So my argument or my question has always been, well, what were the charges that were put on the table? Did they just put intentional murder? Did they put a hate crime for the fact that they called my father the N-word? Were there any other charges, lesser charges, criminally negligent homicide, manslaughter? We don't know. So, and because of grand jury secrecy laws, they have not revealed that to us. So I've been asking that those minutes be unsealed now. We know that the witnesses were police officers, so there shouldn't be an issue with regard to unsealing them.
Mayo Bartlett, we talked about Officer Hart. He actually died in a car crash, is that right? And was going to testify, would have testified on behalf of Kenneth Chamberlain. Can you talk about that controversy around the use of the epithet, the N-word, when they were going after Mr. Chamberlain?
Absolutely. Well, Amy, first, he would have testified on behalf of the White Plains city of White Plains, but we believe his testimony would have been very favorable because his testimony would have shown that at the time of the shooting, Mr. Chamberlain was on his back and they could see the soles of his shoes. With respect to the epithet, we really don't know whether he's the one who has used that slur. So we've been told that by the city, but we're not certain. He did die in a car accident. Unfortunately, he died before we were able even to take a deposition that would be able to allow him at trial to testify.
And what happened with Officer Anthony Corelli? Explain who it was who shot Mr. Chamberlain dead.
Officer Corelli was the point officer, so he was an officer who was there to cover to make sure that the other officers would be safe if there was an interaction that became violent. And Officer Corelli is the one who ultimately fired the shot that killed Mr. Chamberlain. But in our estimation, even
though
he's
the one
who was
the shooter, this was not the taser.
We think that but for the behavior of the supervisors, he would never have been there. In fact, they were there on a medical call, and on any medical call, it's hard to believe that law enforcement is the first to arrive. And in fact, during the entire interaction, no medical personnel were ever given an opportunity to even meet with Mr. Chamberlain or to speak with Mr. Chamberlain.
I mean, this is truly astounding, Kenneth Chamberlain Jr. Your aunt was there, right, in the hallway, Mr. Chamberlain's sister, and she told the police that he was suffering from mental health issues, from PTSD, and they had to be very, very careful. Is that right?
Well, my aunt was on the phone speaking to them. It was my aunt's daughter, my cousin Tanya, who was in the hallway. And you even hear in the audio when they ask, do you have family? You hear her very loudly say, yes, he does. But they totally ignored her. They acted as if she wasn't even there.
You have come to devote your life, Ken Chamberlain Jr., to say the least, very effectively, to dealing with the issue of police brutality. Talk about the group you formed and how you've been dealing with this over the last more than a decade.
So after the killing of my father, we formed the Westchester Coalition for Police Reform. This coalition, you know, the bottom line is that we're looking at transparency. We want to work with local law enforcement agencies in order to build trust between law enforcement and the communities that they serve. But even bigger than that, now what I want to do is create a foundation now in my father's name where we're really going to look at best practices and really push so that the rule of law is adhered to, meaning that the government, its agents and officials will be held to the same set of rules that enables a fair and functioning society. So we're going to be pushing to put laws in place and different mechanisms so that, God forbid, any other family has to deal with situations like this, we'll have something real in place. And we won't be trying to figure out how to put a blueprint together. We'll have a blueprint.
Mayo Bartlett, is this one of the largest settlements the city of White Plains has ever made with a victim of police brutality?
Yes, my understanding is that this is the largest settlement with respect to police brutality from the city of White Plains.
And, I mean, you are the former chief of the Bias Crimes Unit of the Westchester DA's office, also former chair of the Westchester County Human Rights Commission. Do you feel that the situation is getting any better? What kind of regulation of police is there?
Well, it's interesting. In New York State, only 25% of the police departments are actually certified. So the fact that we have that, and the fact that in Westchester County only 50% are, is a significant problem. It means that there's no uniform training. You don't have an expectation that any particular police department is going to behave the way another would. So what we're asking for is unified standards. We think also that it can't come in the form of an executive order, but we need actual structural change. It has to be something that's codified in law, and that police themselves should be required to have a license, as do accountants, beauticians, barbers, lawyers, doctors, and that if they engage in certain misconduct, that they would lose that license and not be able to simply resign and go to another police department. Too often we rely on executive orders, and executive orders, although they may be a great stopgap, go away once the next administration comes into power.
Mm. The White Plains Police Benevolent Association has said, to be clear, the settlement is not a finding of misconduct or wrongdoing by the officers who responded to this call. Our members are asked to place their lives in jeopardy each and every day, as they were on the date of this incident. I'd like you each to respond as we begin to wrap up this conversation, beginning with Mayo Bartlett.
I think that it's unfortunate that sometimes PBAs miss opportunities to bring people together. When you consistently find no wrongdoing, irrespective of the conduct, whether you're watching 20 officers or more beat Rodney King, or you're watching other clear missteps and atrocities, to always say that we've done nothing wrong, I think, does not invite the conversation that we can have, which can bridge the gap and can actually build confidence through transparency. The city itself made a very different statement, and their statement was that they want to continue to improve the department, they want to have more training, and they want to take steps to make sure that things like what happened to Mr. Chamberlain don't happen again. I think that that's a more accurate and helpful statement, and unfortunately, the statement of the PBA does not, in my opinion, benefit the officers who work in the city of White Plains or anywhere else.
And Kenneth Chamberlain,
I would just add to that,
have about a minute, and I wanted to give you the last word, Kenneth Chamberlain, on that issue and any other you want to address right now.
Okay, well, I would just simply say that 2 years ago, the current district attorney conducted a review around the killing of my father to see if there could be any new charges brought forth in this. But that means that they reviewed what the original charges were. So I would just simply ask that they give us the actual review from Deborah Voice and unseal the grand jury minutes. And although we know it's not what you know, it's what you can prove, I believe that if you do unseal these things, that we'll see that there was bias in favor of law enforcement. And other than that, may there be accountability for Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., and may there be accountability for all families impacted by police violence.
Well, again, our condolences. They are never too late, unfortunately. Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., son of Kenneth Chamberlain, shot dead by police in White Plains in New York in November of 2011. And Mayo Bartlett, attorney for the Chamberlain family. The city of White Plains, New York, has agreed to a $5 million settlement with the Chamberlain family, the largest settlement around police violence in White Plains ever. That does it for our show. To see our past interviews, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Hello.
This is
Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.